I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to uncork a conversation that people will want to sip and savor. We're going to talk about wine, Indiana wines to be specific. My guests are Purdue Extension wine specialist Katie Barnett, food and wine expert Jolene Ketzenberger, and Conn's Fine Wines owner Jim Arnold. Please join the conversation. Call us at 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We've got a fun one for you today. We're going to be talking about wine, specifically about Indiana wines. If you've got questions for our panel of wine experts or want to share some of your favorites, this is the show for you. So please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Purdue Extension wine specialist Katie Barnett, food and wine expert Jolene Ketzenberger, and Conn's Fine Wines owner Jim Arnold. Welcome to all of you.
Well, thank you.
Good to be here.
Yeah.
It's good to have you all here on this beautiful day. So I think probably one of the ways I want to dive into Indiana wines, but I think one of the things that fascinates me about this is, you know, the notion of an Indiana wine industry at the level that we have right now. 50 years ago probably would have been considered, you know, the stuff of science fiction. And it's not just the Indiana that's doing it. I mean, all of these places, wine increasingly is sort of becoming a way we define locale and the experience of traveling to other places, because it is a different experience. Drinking wine in California is a different experience from drinking it in Virginia and vice versa. So could we talk a little bit, Katie, about how this explosion occurred, what produced it?
Absolutely. Well, I think one of the funnest facts that I've come across is that in 2018, Indiana wine is up 200% from 2006. And those are just the numbers of wineries. So there's over 116 wineries and vineyards, wineries and tasting rooms in the state of Indiana. And to think about 92 counties, over 68 of those counties house an Indiana winery. And, you know, just to think of all the wine that we're producing, we have almost 4,000 full-time jobs throughout the state of Indiana in our wineries and vineyards. We actually just did an economic impact study here this spring and found that Indiana produces 2.4 million gallons of wine. That's a lot of wine.
Well, that's a lot of wine. That'll get you through the weekend.
Hopefully.
And it has become a big tourism draw as well. You know, we see more than 90 million in wine-related tourism, you know, in Indiana. So it's become a fun thing to do, to go to a lot of our wineries. Not just, you know, it's not just that we're enjoying more wine at home, but we are enjoying it out as well.
We've talked about the what. We've got the scope of this, the why. Who were the pioneers, the ones who sort of saw down the line and realized actually this could be something?
Well, I've been doing this 30 years now, and I've absolutely seen a dramatic change in what's happening. One thing that a lot of people don't know is that actually 100 years ago, there was a burgeoning wine business in Indiana, and it was happening. And then it kind of went to sleep and fell apart, and then it all went to California.
Was it Prohibition?
I think it just dried up, and but obviously in the last 25 years, we've seen a dramatic movement. And I think it's not just the winery. It's the beer business. It's the distilleries. There is a micro movement that's happened in the last 15 years where people want to eat and drink local, and we're getting good quality product to do it with. And I think it's become popular.
What percentage of your business or your sales would you say comes from Indiana wines?
Oh, gosh. Or I'd love to tell you a bigger number. It's not a huge number, but it's better than it's ever been. I would say of my wine business, it might be 3 or 4 or 5%.
Okay.
But it was always under one.
Okay.
You know, and it's growing for sure. And, you know, I can tell you I used to carry maybe three wineries, the big old original ones.
Of
you know,
course.
Easley, Chateau Thomas, and Oliver.
Mm-hmm.
Now
mm-hmm.
I carry 25 wineries, and I carry almost 200 SKUs of different Indiana wines, and they all sell. Mm-hmm. And what's amazing is how much we ship of them.
Mm-hmm.
Ship them out of state. I can't legally ship in-state, which is one of the stupidest laws we have, but I can ship out of state to states where legal, and I'm shipping wines almost every day that are Indiana wines.
Yeah, we could do an entire year's worth of shows, I think.
On the Indiana laws?
Yes.
It's particularly yes. those dealing with alcohol in this state and the intricacy. So in terms of what Jim is talking about, this explosion, how has it transformed the way people look at Indiana wines? Because there was, you know, I mean, I'll date myself, but, you know, when, and some of this comes from the fact that my late father-in-law was French and had a built-in bias, obviously, towards a good Bordeaux or a good Burgundy. I'm happy to say he passed that along to his son-in-law. But, you know, there was a certain amount of skepticism, not just about Indiana wines, but American wines up through the 60s and 70s. California kind of cracked that wall, but now we're seeing it come down everywhere. What did that, do you think, Jolene?
You know, I think that, of course, California, you know, and the success there has played a big role in that. As far as Indiana wines, you know, I still think we have a ways to go with, mm-hmm. with perception on the wines. You know, they are not all sweet, mm-hmm. you know, granted, you know, Oliver Soft Red, top selling Indiana wine, but they're not
top
all
top selling wine in Indiana.
Right. Yes.
Number one selling wine in Indiana is Oliver Soft Red.
Yes. Okay. So not just from among Indiana wines. So there is that perception, though, that sort of defines the category. But we're seeing more and more broadening of the category, with more success with the dry wines as well.
If you are just joining us, we're talking about Indiana wines today here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what a listener named Cameron has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Cameron, you're on the air.
Hi there. How are you?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
That's wonderful. When you guys started talking about local Indiana wines, the very first thing I thought of was a small company called Fruit Shine Wine in Monticello, Indiana. Have you guys had plans to talk about that one yet?
Well, we were, you know, we're actually just taking this conversation wherever it leads. So I'll throw that to Katie because she nodded in affirmation when you mentioned it. Thanks very much for the call, Cameron.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Fruit Shine is absolutely amazing. All natural, and they're right by my great aunt and uncle's place, so I drink that stuff all the time.
Okay. All right, Katie, thank you.
Absolutely. So Fruit Shine Wine is located in Monticello, Indiana, right on the lake. So it's a big kind of Saturday morning adventure. Go to the winery before you head out to the lake. White Horse is also right there on the lake as well. But Fruit Shine Wines are served chilled, so they must be served cold. It's just a nice, refreshing kind of Saturday afternoon wine, especially the heat that we've had. I think it's very, very nice to cool down with some Fruit Shine Wine.
But a lot of those similar wineries have been seeing lots of event, you know, success, you know, where you go out to the winery on a Saturday or a Friday evening. There's music, there's food, there's food trucks. It's become entertainment.
Absolutely. I think the thing that Indiana has done a lot recently to set them apart is making wine as an art. And I think the wineries have really embraced that Hoosier hospitality to add events and local artists and local food trucks. And it's more than just, oh, let's go to the winery and buy a bottle of wine. You know, I hear the stories of we spent 4 hours and 6 hours at the winery and had dinner and met some, you know, great friends and and listen to great music. And then all of a sudden we had to get home because it was midnight, you know. And those are neat stories for me to hear and grow with.
Oh, sure. You know, and there has been a lot of expansion and development in the event category. I know, like at Mallow Run in Bargersville, you know, big event space, the Daniels Family Vineyard and Winery in McCordsville. Lots of room for events, weddings, you know, all sorts of things.
Are there specific parts of the state that have had more success than others with establishing vineyards and wineries? I mean, I'm thinking my family and I were just on vacation in Colorado and Utah, and we stopped at this tiny little town. The name of it is escaping me at the moment, Western Colorado, which apparently has just exploded and become kind of the wine capital of Colorado. It's famous for wine and peaches. And literally, you drive in there and they're handing out maps. There are like 15 vineyards, you know, within just right around the little town center itself. Is there anything quite like that here?
We have the Indiana Wine Trail, don't we, or something?
We have several Indiana wine trails. We were just recently written up in Food and Wine magazine, actually, for the Indiana Grown Wine Trail. It has 31 wineries stretching, you know, all across the state. I'd say, you know, originally it was Southern Indiana, you know, and of course, you know, Oliver Winery, you know, since 1972, has been big, you know, in that area. We have two AVAs, American Viticultural Areas, you know, the designated areas here in Indiana. We're part of the Ohio River Valley AVA, which also takes in Ohio and Kentucky. But we also have the Indiana Uplands area, which is, you know, the Oliver Winery area. So I think that you've seen, you know, a lot of development there historically. But, you know, lately I'm seeing a lot of wineries opening in northern Indiana.
Yeah. Northeast especially has welcomed probably three or four within the last 5 years.
Exactly.
But there's actually 18 varieties of grapes that grow well in Indiana, north to south, east to west. And there's a publication you can find online at Explore Indiana Wines or indianawines.org that'll have that. It's a downloadable PDF, but you can actually see pictures of all of those grapes. And speaking of grapes, right now is harvest time in the vineyard. So, you know, if you've ever wondered what it was like to harvest grapes, call up your local winery and just see if you can spend 30 minutes, 2 hours. I'm sure they would accept six or seven hours as well.
Some free labor.
I'm sure they would. You know, I drove back and forth on Interstate 74 for years watching Buck Creek Winery develop their vineyard there. And so it was always very interesting for me to see the grapes growing right off the highway.
Absolutely.
You know, and so you can see that.
Well, you know, and to put it one quick in kind of simple terms, think where the rivers are, think where the water is. That's the best place for the vineyards, not necessarily because of the water, but because in the cold winters here, you get a moderate temperature coming off the water. So if you're along Lake Michigan or you're along the Ohio River, you don't get the freezes that kill the vines. And that's why those were the main burgeoning areas for growing grapes.
When did you notice, Jim, when did you start noticing that the demand for Indiana wines was increasing?
I'd say 10 years ago it started really growing. And now we take pride in carrying a huge selection. And they all, like I said earlier, I think they all sell. And both them dry and the sweet.
Which were the wines that first sort of knocked down that door that created it?
Charlie Thomas was without question the first to really want to make dry wine in Indiana and make good dry wine. And he bought most of his grapes from California to do it because those vinifera varietals don't do well in the really cold temperature of the winter. But all the wineries are trying to make some dry wines now. No question that the most popular is still sweet, but they're making half sweet and dry.
Exactly.
And they're very proud of their dry wines. And that's where they really want to go in that direction, because they know that that's – people start drinking wine sweet and they move to dry. And we're a Coca-Cola society. Everybody likes stuff sweet. But really, dry wines go better with food. And really, that's what wine is all about.
And at least with the reds, I know for those of us who are middle-aged men, it's better for your heart, too. They recommend that.
Right. I'm going to live a long time.
Yeah, me too.
You and me both, brother. We are talking about Indiana wines today here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do so in several ways. You can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests today are Purdue Extension wine specialist Katie Barnett, food and wine expert Jolene Ketzenberger, and Jim Arnold, the owner of Conn's Fine Wines. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about wine, Indiana wines, to be precise. My guests are Purdue Extension wine specialist Katie Barnett, food and wine expert Jolene Ketzenberger, and Jim Arnold, the owner of Conn's Fine Wines. I'm really, really sad to report that I am the only one in the studio right now not sipping a glass of wine. Hosts aren't supposed to do that. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what Greg has done and call us at 866-476-3881. Greg, you're on the air.
Hi, long-time listener, first-time caller. I just wanted to ask a question about the distribution numbers you gave earlier. You mentioned it's gone up in the last 10 years or so from 1% to 4 or 5%. Does that include alternative wines like honey wines and sparkling meads and things like that from places like New Day Craft in Fountain Square?
Yes. Good question. Thanks very much for the call, Greg.
Yes, it does. In fact, we carry New Day at the store as well as we just brought in a wonderful line of lemon wines. There's just all kinds of different things happening right now, and people love to try them.
Oh, absolutely! I've been following New Day's evolution. As a matter of fact, from their you know honey wines, you know when they were located in Elwood back in the day, to their focus then on meads and hard ciders. These days, you know, in their at the Fountain Square tasting room, they've got some new products coming out. They're ramping up production. I think they're doing great stuff. Although it is interesting to note that a lot of the hard cider and mead makers tend to identify more closely with the craft beer movement, the craft beer drinker, rather than the wineries, even though they are categorized as wineries.
Yeah, that's what I was going to follow up with. When you apply to be a winery in the state of Indiana, you apply for a farm winery permit. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people think that those ciders and meads fall under the beer category. However, they are technically a farm winery in the state of Indiana. So when we look and we talk about, you know, there's 98 wineries, 116 tasting rooms and wineries, they're in that number. All the meaderies and all the cideries are. And wineries.
Yeah, and at retail, I think in most stores, you'll find the ciders and the meads to be sold nearer to the beer department.
Exactly.
Than
exactly.
With the Indiana wines.
Mm-hmm. So, Katie, you mentioned in the last segment that there are 18, I think, grapes that are good for making wine that work here in Indiana. What are they? What kinds of wine do they result in?
So there's 18 varieties that work well throughout the state. There's many more that can only be grown in the Northeast because they're more cold hardy, and there's some that can grow better in the South because they have better temperature. But I actually brought three bags of many clusters of grapes to the studio, and we actually just sampled some Traminette grapes. And so Traminette is the state wine and wine grape of Indiana. So it's a kind of a nice, refreshing wine. It's got some fruitful, sometimes it can be spicy, if you can understand that. And it's also related to a Gewürztraminer. So I know that's kind of a popular summer wine as well. I actually love to go pick some Traminette grapes and put the grapes in the wine and just kind of enjoy it throughout the summer with some ice and that kind of stuff.
Oh, but actually, absolutely.
Indiana has red wines. We can make rosés very nice as well. We have three different varieties that kind of go into a rosé, and I actually brought Creek Bend, which is Oliver, their Catawba, which is grown in Indiana, and it is a sparkling wine. It's one of my favorites, just nice, cool, you know, cool off wine. But it's different, and I love taking it places because people don't realize that Indiana, you know, can grow the selection that we can.
It's not all big, jammy grapes.
Absolutely.
Although Concord, you know, is a grape that, that grows here.
And Indiana has over 600 acres of vineyards, again, throughout the state. So really, you can find, you know, huge portfolio like an Oliver winery, and you can find something small like a Heartland winery in Northeast Indiana.
Again, with the Northeast Indiana.
Yeah.
Wow. So how long, I mean... I love to drink wine. I know just enough about it to be dangerous, though. but there's a certain inherent curiosity. And I remember talking with, not here in Indiana, actually in California, with a guy who had worked at a vineyard just about, you know, sort of the how much effort goes into making wine. And I think, if my memory serves me right, he said that, like, to produce a good Cabernet, it's really about 20 years that you have to invest in those vines, that they have to become mature. So, you know, at some level, how long have these folks had to toil in the vineyards, to use the cliche, to bring this industry to this kind of level, Jolene?
Well, Oliver opened in 1972,
okay.
so it's been a minute, you know, that we've been working toward this. You know, I know that like Buck Creek Winery that I mentioned on 74, you know, those were planted well in advance of the owner retiring from his previous job, you know, so that they were then you know, could be up and running. But you know, it does take a while to get things growing. That's why often you see the vineyard growing before the winery opens.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's generally a minimum of 4 years before you start to get good fruit off of a vine. Two, you get fruit, but it's really not very good. Four starts to get decent. 8, 10, 12 years is when they're really producing good fruit, and 20 maybe when they're at their peak type
of
thing.
So you've got to do this, then a lot of these folks had to be willing to basically invest both time, money, and energy.
Well, also technology today, we cheat.
Okay.
They buy grapes.
Okay.
So they may be planting their grapes to get up and going, but they're buying fruit the minute they open so that they can make wine and start selling things. And most of the wineries tried to buy grapes and the styles of what they wanted to make down the road so that there would be an easy transition.
Mm-hmm. What are the, Jolene, you've said several times here that it's not just sweet wine anymore, and that's
right.
But that was obviously what Indiana First was known for. What wines are we known for?
Well, you know, obviously, you know, the Oliver Soft Red, Soft White, you know, the Reggae Red from Easley Winery, you know, those fun, easy drinking wines, you know, patio pounders, you know, that people like to, you know, this sort of chill it and kill it kind of wines. Those are very fun, and there's absolutely, you know, a place for those kind of wines here. We love them, and I don't want to say, you know, it's not just Indiana that has a sweet palate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a good part of the country, you know, does, you know, also favors, you know, that sort of sweet flavor profile.
What are the dry wines, though, that really started to crack the ceiling here or crack through the wall, Katie?
Well, I think our dry wines are still a work in progress. I think there's a lot of wineries that do many dry wines well. But it's still relatively new for Indiana because we have to get those grapes from California. So whether we get those grapes as a whole or whether we get their juice. And then once we get that fruit to the winery, it's all about how then the winemaker takes that fruit and processes it further. So it's not just, oh, look, I have these, you know, Merlot grapes. We can, you know, make Merlot overnight like we can a sweet wine. It's much longer, much more art and work goes into that.
And also you have to remember that they have to make what their customers want to drink as well. You know,
perhaps, it is a business.
It is a business. So perhaps, you know, they might prefer to drink, you know, a dry red. But if their customers want a sweet white, well, they better be making a sweet white as well.
Are there certain kinds of wine that, you know, Indiana just will never be able to produce because of the soil and the climate here? Katie, you're nodding.
Yeah, a lot of your Merlots and your Cabernets, we just don't have the weather for it. And when we talk about the vineyard, you know, Traminette kind of took a hit in 2014 because of the late frost that we had.
Oh, yeah.
Killed so much of our vines. Even at Purdue, the vines that I got the Traminette from this morning, you know, sometimes you have to look at them and you think, you know, why do we do this? Why is this, you know, our lives just in every agriculture product? And it's hard to look at those years. But I mean, we all know Indiana's weather is kind of funny anyways. But
oh, absolutely.
Schizophrenic is the
absolutely.
Word.
Yeah. You know, all fruit producers know that, you know, you're not going to get a crop every year. Mm-hmm. You know, the peaches this year might be awesome, but, you know, last year, not so much.
That's why we really emphasize just do your homework. You know, what will absolutely never work because it's not ever going to be worth it, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's certain grapes that need so many days of sunshine to ripen.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And we have more grays of days of gray than we have days of sunshine, unfortunately, versus the Central Valley in California or Napa or Sonoma, which have 345 days of sunshine a year.
Well, and all of our rain, you know, we could get 6 inches of rain in a month. You know, in the summertime. And that, you know, that's just not happening in Napa, you know.
Yeah, and vines prefer to struggle. Mm-hmm. They don't love a ton of rain. And our soil is generally more moist here. So some of those other bigger, drier type wines, they don't like the wetness.
If you are just joining us, we're talking about wine today on No Limits, Indiana wines, to be precise. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So Jolene is now pouring the second bottle of wine here. This is a game that they're playing.
And that first one was really good.
It's called torture the host.
Right.
You know, drink in front of him.
But, you know, it is important that, you know, when you talk about wine that you do taste Indiana wine as well. You know, if you have just that idea in your head of you know, the sweet, jammy wines, you know, you need to try some of the others.
So what are you opening right now?
So this is a dry red blend from Oliver from 2016. Just as an example, that we do make perfectly lovely dry wines and award-winning wines as well. I judged this year and last year at the Indiana National Wine Competition at Purdue.
Yeah.
It's an awesome competition. Our Indiana wineries do quite well there, although there are almost 2,000 entries from wineries around the world, actually. Indiana is making some good award-winning dry wines.
Jim, we've talked about the big dogs, you know, the ones, the major... Who are some of the up-and-comers, the folks that you're seeing developing real followings here?
I think 2E's is doing good stuff. I think Buck Creek is doing a nice job on their wines.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the other newer ones, well, another longtime one is Huber.
Oh, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And they're now a distillery. They've got all kinds of things going
everything.
On. Doing.
Yeah.
Well, if I recall, I did a feature story when I was at the paper years ago about Huber Wine. They have a petting zoo, all kinds of things.
Yes.
Their distillery is doing great stuff as well.
They were one of the first in Indiana to be in the winery business.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that, there's the wine business and the winery business.
Yes.
The winery business is bringing people to the winery to entertain them. And Huber's been doing it a long time.
Yes, absolutely. That whole agritourism kind of thing, they do it in a big way and they do it well.
Who is right now, would you say, is making the most distinctive wines? You know, or not? They
no
aren't
matter
necessarily
who we say, we're going to make a bunch of other people mad at us.
Well, let me define the term here, because what I want to get at is obviously some of these are run as to be thriving businesses. I suspect there are more than a few, knowing a little bit of who are doing the wine simply because it's a passion. And mm-hmm. while they like to close the year with, you know, with a dollar more than they spent on it, they don't care that much about profit and loss as much as they do just making something that is very different or distinctive.
Well,
Who falls into that category?
I don't know, but I would say they should all be very concerned about profit and loss, or they're not going to be making wine for very much longer.
In fact, with all the movements, the beer, the distillery, and the wine, I think you're going to see this growth, and then you're going to see a shrink back.
Yes.
Like we've already started to see some of the breweries close.
Yes.
Yep.
And the best ones and the best quality and the best service, they're the ones that are going to survive. And the wineries are no different. To go back to your – I will say this. The one person that has called on me from all these wineries over the years, Charlie Thomas, wanted to make dry wine. He made his family reserves that were made to a $50 price point.
Mm-hmm.
They got great ratings in the 90s, you know, good quality stuff made here. He just threw his hands up one day and said, they want sweet. And I got to give them what they want. And now I'm selling blackberry Merlot and strawberry blush. You know,
the wineries might not want to make, you know, to have their frosé machine going, you know, with their little their frozen rosé. But they got to pay the bills. And that sells and people want to enjoy their frozen rosé. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, if that's what you enjoy, you know, enjoy it. And then drink wine and try new things. And then you'll find another thing that you enjoy as well.
Katie, I'm going to redirect a little bit then. Are there wines out there that are just specific to Indiana that, you know, the grapes can't be grown anywhere else? Or, you know, like we were talking about, that lemon wines or whatever that that come from something that is, you know, intrinsically Hoosier?
I would say probably not. At Purdue, we do a lot of research with Minnesota. We work with Cornell quite a bit as well. So we can go to the vineyard at Purdue and, you know, read off some research vines that haven't been named yet. You know, they're, you know, R7 dash a number. And, you know, we may see those in 3 or 4 years. But,
yes.
You know, when we see those vines and those grapes, we're looking at disease resistancy, cluster size, you know, and then how much juice are they going to produce at the end of the day. But, you know, I think the wine industry is interesting right now because we really have 3 generations of wine drinkers. And myself as a millennial, you know, people ask me all the time, what do you like? You as a, you know, a young person, what do you like to drink? And the answer is we don't know that data yet. And the millennials are still pretty new. So we're just gathering how my generation, the millennials, enjoy wine and what kind of wine we like to enjoy. And it's interesting, you know, I go to conferences and I read reports from Gallo in California about what their research says. And it's so new and it's so different because the millennials are just kind of this, you know, toss-up generation right now. Mm-hmm. What are they going to do?
But it's a big cohort and it's going to be very exciting to see what they settle into. Oftentimes they've been raised by parents who are wine drinkers. And so it's not hard for them to become, you know, enamored with wines. You know, they've in many cases grown up with that, you know, a familiarity with artisan food and farmers markets and wines and craft beer. So it's kind of a natural for them.
And that's so interesting. Growing up myself, I always went to wine. You know, I spent a semester in Italy, which probably helped a little bit, but yeah, you know, wine was always my go-to.
Sure. Well, you know what? I think the millennials and the Gen Xers and the kind of 21 to 30-year-olds right now, or some start younger, but based on their parents. Mm-hmm. But they started in the craft beer movement.
Mm-hmm.
They are all over the cocktail craze.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to move to wine. Mm-hmm. There's no question. It's a natural progression. They'll probably start with sweeter wines, but by the time they're in their mid-30s, they're going to be drinking dry wine. And I think that we should see some really nice growth on that in Indiana.
We are talking about wine, Indiana wines, to be precise today on No Limits. My guests are Purdue Extension wine specialist Katie Barnett, food and wine expert Jolene Ketzenberger, and Jim Arnold, the owner of Conn's Fine Wines. If you want to join the conversation, you can do it in several ways. You can give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. And this being the 21st century, you also can reach out to us on social media. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about wine on No Limits, Indiana wines. My guests are Purdue Extension wine specialist Katie Barnett, food and wine expert Jolene Ketzenberger, and Jim Arnold, the owner of Conn's Fine Wines, I should say. I am the only one in the studio who is not drinking wine today, so, you know, this is a reason to feel sorry for me. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named David has done and send us an email. Our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. David writes, there is a great new place up in Westfield called Urban Vines, run by a local farmer. His farm is across the street, a quarter mile down. He makes all the wine and beer he sells. Bingo one night, trivia another, live music on the weekend on a stage out back. And one of the best things ever, wine smoothies. You see the machine spinning the frozen concoction until you order. I found them because I'm their FedEx delivery driver. So Katie, tell us all about wine smoothies.
Here. Oh, so they're slushies, they're smoothies. Mm-hmm. Hopwood Cellars in Zionsville actually makes a wine milkshake. So there's many frozen treats to try. I feel like slushies are kind of pretty popular right now. You can just about any type of wine in a slushie. And it's a nice summer drink.
Oh, it's great. You know, and there's, you know, I think drinking seasonally is a fun thing. You know, I've been all about the rosés this summer. And so, you know, I don't mind that, you know, having your frozen rosé slushy in the summertime, you know, but then probably in the fall, you know, I'll kind of transition into the bigger reds. Do you see that happening, you know, with shoppers?
There's no question. I call Labor Day the transition time. Golf people right. start to think about putting their golf clubs away and getting their skis out, thinking about drinking red wines that are more indoor drinking than outdoor drinking. And you know what? I'm a firm believer in drink what you like, when you like, with what you like, and who you like. And if you want to put an ice cube in your wine, so be it. You know what? That's maybe the precursor to smoothies.
But let's explore that a little bit, because I kind of suspect that people of my parents' generation or grandparents would not dream of having a wine slushy or smoothie or anything.
I don't know. There were those frozen grasshopper drinks back in the day, maybe. Maybe it's not true. Such a leap.
That's true. But when did it, did this whole new, and in some ways it's, we're talking about new delivery systems for the most part. When did that take?
I would say the last probably 5 to 7 years is when we've seen this craze. But, you know, we also see wine in cans, wine in Tetra packaging.
Exactly.
Glass bottles, you know, they're not the traditional wine style bottle anymore. There's hundreds upon hundreds of ways to package. Again, I think it's generational. I think it's new market. It's
screw
trendy.
Caps.
Oh, screw caps that we just unscrewed here. You know, that had, you know, a lot of pushback from consumers at first as well.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I just tried.
Zero pushback now.
Now they would like
maybe
that.
Maybe the wine snob. You're not seeing $50 Cabernets in a screw cap.
Uh-huh. But I do see customers requesting a screw cap because they're going somewhere and they're not packing a wine key to open it. And like you said, the canned wines. You know, I just tried one the other day. Perfectly lovely red wine in a can. And how handy would that be for events where you can't take glass bottles in?
We are talking about Indiana wines today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what Bianca has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Bianca, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for taking my call. And I'm so glad that Indiana Wine is getting a spotlight. I love Indiana wines, and there's just been so many in the last couple of years. I'm really excited about it. My first experience with an Indiana winery was Wildcat Creek Winery up in Lafayette, where they don't actually grow their own grapes. I've noticed that's kind of changing a little bit. Do you guys notice that we're getting more Indiana-grown grapes, and are they using those to make their juice as well? And then sort of as an add-on question, how are you seeing maybe our climate change is affecting, you know, the types of grapes that we can grow, or maybe the hardiness or the different varieties?
Thanks very much for the call and the great questions, Bianca. Katie, everybody's looking in your direction.
Oh, boy. I mean, we can have a full 7-day discussion about climate change. But so back to White Horse and Monticello. So they have a vineyard. It's just not in Monticello. It's actually in Logansport. Some of the wineries do that just for better soil types. They'd have them in southern Indiana or different parts. So more wineries are growing vineyards. Some of them are more just, you know, ornamental vineyards just to see the grapevine. So there's an agriculture education piece to that. They are very, very labor intensive, though. So for, you know, a winery that is more of just a hobby, it's easier in all ways and more affordable to just get grapes from other places. Even still in the Midwest, you know, we think about Michigan, you know, our neighbor to the north has, you know, a tremendous amount of winery in vineyards that we can just ship fruit, you know, get it in a day or 2 days. But because they're so labor intensive, you know, that's almost a whole different set of employees. If you're in the Indianapolis area, Daniel's Vineyard has a tremendous vineyard as you pull up to the winery, you know, and I always encourage people to go in a vineyard and see what it is to understand. This year we fought some Japanese beetles that take our beautiful leaves and, you know, poke holes in all of them. You know, we deal with, obviously, we talked about the weather earlier, different diseases, pesticide, and, you know, all that stuff that we have to spray for. It's a lot. So it's an opportunity cost with a winery, right? So what is the cost to not have it versus to have it?
Well, and think about some of the wineries are right here in the middle of the city, you know, Easley Winery. Yeah. It's an urban winery. So no, there's not grapes growing right close at hand, you know.
What are the margins like on something, you know, on launching a vineyard or a winery? I mean, as Katie was talking, well, for some reason, I referenced back to a friend of mine who got into the racing business, bought a race car, and joked to me, he said, you want to know how to make a small fortune in racing? He said, start with a large fortune.
That is exactly what I was going to say.
Okay. So what does it take to make money in this business? Jim, I'll start with you.
Well, first of all, you have to have some volume. You've got to be able to push some boxes out the door in order to pay the light bills. And it's for a lot of wineries, it is a love that starts with just the winemaker and his or her wife or husband and their chief bottle wash cook.
Exactly.
They pay the bills. They do everything. And it's a small love of the family business to get started. Hopefully they can get up to where they're making 2,000 or 3,000 cases and maybe hire another employee and then get to 5,000 cases. But it's tight. It's like farming. It's hard business.
Yeah. And I think it starts out, you know, like a lot of we've talked about the comparisons to the craft brewing movement. You know, it starts, you know, with that often starts with somebody who's a home brewer. And then they take their, you know, they're going to go, they start ramping up, and then they're a micro brewer, and then it just builds from there. So I think sometimes the wineries do start, you know, like that with the home winemakers, but then, like you said, they do have to scale up very quickly and build that following, you know, because like we said, it's a business, and you've got to build that business part of it. So I assume, Katie, that you see a lot of people coming to Purdue for advice on the business aspect of it.
Absolutely. So the Purdue Wine Grape Team was started in 1991, and there's four of us that are at Purdue that kind of helped the Indiana wine industry get up and going. So we have anything from viticulture.
You were not there in 1991.
Though. I was not there in 1991, just a few years later.
Okay.
But we help people anywhere from the making of the wine to the growing of the grapes. And so we have workshops 4 or 5 times a year where we invite anybody, whether you're a winemaker, you know, in the craft beer industry, maybe you're just exploring, to come learn about wine and growing grapes. Because when we think about it, a good bottle of wine is great to have, but what goes into that bottle? That's chemistry. That's science. Those are formulas and trials. We test wine, so we test pH and we test alcohol levels. All of that goes into, and much more, goes into a good bottle of wine. So it's not just about growing good grapes and crushing them and fermenting and adding some sugar and calling it a day. And so that's what the Purdue Wine Grape Team really tries to do, is just propel the Indiana wine industry. And with that, Jolene mentioned the Indy International, a wine competition, and that's the largest scientifically organized wine competition in the United States.
It's incredible.
Yeah, and we have an amateur winemaker division that we've seen many Indiana winemakers enter when they're first starting out, because you get a remark sheet at the end of that. So the judges go through and they say, you know, I wish it had this, or I'm picking up notes of this, or maybe you should add this. And that's really, really helped. And it's home. It's at Purdue. It's in Indiana. And that's really neat. 2,000 bottles of wine just at the end of May, first weekend of June, in that time area. It's tremendous, honestly, to see.
I judged that a few years back, and there were also ones that you would taste and say, I wish I didn't taste it.
Absolutely.
That's
part of learning.
But
exactly.
Lots of good ones, not but all some of them, that were scary.
Not all of them are good. Yeah. You know, that is true.
So, Katie, earlier on you mentioned also that the wineries fall under a different kind of permitting process than we talk a little bit. So it's not just something you can say at 1 o'clock in the morning, oh, you know, I think I'll start making wine for a living and, you know, get started. So what is the permitting process like?
So the permitting process is a lot of paperwork. Let me emphasize a lot. you know, there's different levels of the paperwork from going to your county health department, zoning, all that stuff to get your building permits. Then you apply for a state license. You know, I see people, Brandywine Creek actually just opened, and they're located right by Butt Creek. And they've been to our workshops for 5-7 years, and they just opened. You know, we tell people to open up a winery, it takes time, and that's okay. You don't just want to rush into it overnight and then say, oops, you know, I didn't do that, or I didn't know that, because those come with extra fines. There's a lot that go into it, and I could probably talk for 2 hours about all the paperwork that needs to be done. But reach out to the Purdue Wine Grape Team. That's what we're here to help with.
And we've seen this exponential growth here in the past few years, 98 wineries, as we've talked about during the show. Do we see that slowing at any time, or, you know, hitting a plateau, or do we continue to see?
Well, I don't know.
See the growth continuing at this level.
It has certainly been growing in the last 5 years.
Oh my goodness, yeah, I don't see it slowing down. Maybe not as
high. As long as the local farm movement's good, I think it'll stay growing.
What produced you said there's a slight contraction in the craft beer, you know, a settling out basically of the people who are going to survive and those who didn't make it, and you made comparisons between the two.
I think the biggest thing is it's kind of like, oh, Jim, you own Conn's Fine Wines. You must really be a crazy wine person. And I say, I am a crazy wine person, but I like money too. And you have to be a business person first. Or the passion maybe has to come first, but you have to have a business sense. And I've met tons of people that were incredible wine minds or beer minds, but had no idea how to run a business. And that's something that, like, Purdue can help with, because they have classes and they teach. There's different ways to learn about not only the fermentation side, but also the business side.
But, you know, not everyone who makes something is going to make it really well.
Yeah.
You know, not everyone who picks up a paintbrush is going to be a great artist. Not everyone who picks up a pen is a great writer. You know, so not every craft brewery is making awesome beer, and not every winery is making awesome wine. So I think that's where you see some of the fallout, is the ones that aren't doing it as well and haven't, you know, built as big a following. They will, you know, kind of fall by the wayside.
Katie, what are some of the common mistakes? I mean, the ones that do not thrive, what generally does them in?
I think wine flaws, easily, just because they're unaware of all the wine flaws that there can be. We talk about everything from, you know, sensory to, you know, filling bottles too full to where the corks fly out on a hot summer day. You know, so little things that there's
that
just,
would be bad.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yes. There's just a lot. And, you know, we talked about Purdue and we talked about education. Purdue Food Science actually just introduced a fermentation minor to Purdue students.
I think that's terrific.
So, you know, it's taking those students who have an interest in our industry, no matter what it is, and, you know, educating them. You know, we taught a fermentation sciences class where they learned about meat and cheese and cider and beer and sake. I mean, everything and everything that goes into it. It's not just throw it in the oven like a pizza and it's done, you know. There's just many.
So we're starting to get toward the end of the program. I'm going to start with Jim on this. Give me an example, Indiana wine, that you would consider an as yet undiscovered gem.
Oh, that's a tough one.
One that, you know, that...
Yeah,
that very few people have heard of.
You know what? I'll tell I'll tell you what the undiscovered gem is. I think Traminette. I think that a lot of the wineries are making Traminette. It's quality. It's full flavored. It has the weight of Chardonnay in the mouth, though it doesn't taste like Chardonnay. You know, it tastes different, but makes for a great food wine. You know, 10 years ago, I sold one case of Traminette a year. Now I sell 30 or 40 cases of Traminette a year. I think it'll be 200 cases of Traminette a year in another few years. It's just, I think that versus it being one wine from one winery, I think that's one grape.
Katie.
Well, I'll tell you my favorite Indiana wine is a Catawba. To me, I call it my wind down wine. My family mm-hmm. knows it when they call me at 5 and say, "What are you doing?" I'm like, "Well, I'm winding down. Hope you're having a Catawba." And that's exactly right. I drink it all times of the year. Just it's light, it's refreshing, it's not too heavy. It can be bubbly, it can be still. That's my favorite wine right now.
Jolene.
So I was just drinking just last night a wine from Redig Hill in Osgood, in Ripley County, I think. It was a Vidal Blanc. You know, so a lovely white wine, again, great this time of year, very, you know, refreshing, not sweet, you know, mm-hmm. fruit forward, but not sweet. And I think that sometimes people kind of confuse that, you know, if it tastes of fruit, it's not necessarily a sweet wine.
And, you know, that's only about $11.
It is. Yeah. Right. It's a great value wine.
Absolutely.
And that probably will have to be the last word. I am going to point out again that once again I was the only one who was not drinking during this broadcast. But I would like to thank.
Are you trying to stay out of trouble?
I am trying to stay out of trouble here. Yeah, I think the FCC has some things about that they're not thrilled with. My guests have been Purdue Extension wine specialist Katie Barnett, food and wine expert Jolene Ketzenberger, and Jim Arnold, who is the owner of Conn's Fine Wines. I'd like to thank you all for what has been
you. A
lovely and pleasant conversation about one of my favorite subjects.
Thank you.
Our listeners, as always, for some great questions and comments. I am John Krall. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.